This is Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Other young conservatives all across the country in trying to help change the national picture. We are going to find out more about Indiana's role in all of this. Isaiah Mears is the state chairman of the Indiana Federation of College Republicans, and he is also the chairman of Wabash College Republicans, the organization which is on the Wabash College campus down in Crawfordsville. And Isaiah, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks, Chris, for having me.
Well, first tell us how the campus Republicans in particular are interested in joining in the conversation.
Well, I guess I can kind of give you a little background on me, too. I mean, this is a conversation that's been being had for quite some time now. This isn't something new. This isn't an issue that is just kind of out there. This is something that's been pretty prominent for the last few years. And one thing that we've kind of discovered as young people is, especially on the conservative side, this isn't something that we're prepared to talk about yet. We haven't developed the right language to be able to kind of combat what the left is saying and also come up with solutions of our own. And so being a young conservative, I wanted to kind of take the lead on this and started joining this Young Conservatives for Carbon Dividends Coalition. And this is kind of our way to combat the Green New Deal and our way to kind of develop the language that conservatives need to be able to have these conversations.
I understand that the real goal is to help create a carbon tax. Maybe for folks that are not necessarily familiar with that term, will you explain it from what the coalition has at least passed along to you folks as what they in turn would like to do to help make the changes that are needed?
So a carbon tax would be collected by the Treasury Department, and it's a fee on tons of carbon emissions that are put into our air. And then that fee is returned to the American people in the form of a dividend payment to each American household, and it's 100% of the payments goes right back into the American people.
I understand that a new topic to bring this up, certainly it's been brought up here in the statewide level, but also, too, that we have some national champions for the idea, and one of them is one of our U.S. senators. Tell us how Mike Braun is interested in this campaign.
Fellow Wabash graduate, Senator Braun. He recently joined the Climate Caucus, the only conservative Republican to do that. And he's tipping the scales in the right direction for us, and we're just trying to follow in his footsteps. He's actually even commented on our campaign, and he's excited about it. And he says it's good to see young conservatives interested in having these conversations. And honestly, I think that's what it comes down to, right? It's opening the door, having the conversations, coming up with solutions. From a conservative standpoint, and I think that recently Kevin McCarthy said that we're at the risk of losing an entire generation of young voters if we don't start talking about these issues. And so, like Mike Braun is doing, we're just trying to lead by example. So.
Have you found that since the Republican Party on the national level has rejected the Democrats' proposal of what they're calling the Green New Deal, that all of this kind of gave it the impact that it needed to get this program accelerated?
It's something that we all say that we don't like the Green New Deal, but then when you ask somebody, okay, well, what's your plan to be able to combat that? Nobody really has an idea about that yet. And so, I mean, sure, would we love for our idea to be passed through and for carbon dividends to actually be launched in our government and things like that? Of course. But I think more importantly, we want to be able to start this conversation. And sure, if people have other ideas or want to add onto it or shift and pivot in other directions too. I mean, this is something that we need to start considering. And I think that we're seeing that if we sit on the sidelines here, something like a Green New Deal is going to be put in place and we're not going to like it very much.
And we probably should mention that this is not a brand new idea for Republicans, that you mentioned that past presidential administrations have brought this up. In particular, you mentioned about the George H.W. Bush administration. What did President George H.W. Bush at the time propose, and how did that signal what needs to be done today?
He was doing more on the, I don't know if you remember, the acid rain types of things. And to be able to get rid of that, he implemented a similar program, I guess, is how you would say it, but to be able to tax those things and get rid of it. And then you can also even look at Richard Nixon, too, who arguably was the president that's done the most for climate change with the creation of the EPA and things of that nature. So, I mean, this is something that people forget that Republicans have been championing in the past, and it's something that we're going to continue to do in the future, and we're just trying to lay the groundwork for that.
I know you just recently announced the involvement of the Indiana College Republicans, in particular your colleagues there at Wabash College Republicans, to get involved in this national program. Have you got any feedback within Indiana yet about the idea since it's just been introduced?
Yeah, there has been a number of conservatives that have reached out to me, both nationally and also in the state, that are excited about this. And they said that this is something that they've been thinking about too, but didn't really have an opportunity to be able to express an opinion or to even think about an idea. And so they've reached out and have been supportive. But at the same time too, we've also had some pushback nationally. I'm just going to be completely honest with you. It's something that young conservatives across the country within our College Republicans framework are still trying to discuss and figure out where they stand on it, and we have had some pushback.
Really?
I think that that's healthy, though. I mean, you don't want to just have everybody agree with each other all the time, right? We're starting these conversations and having some pushback. I think that that's healthy, and it's going to only make our plan that much stronger.
Do you think that maybe this pushback, the opposition that you're getting from some of the groups is kind of indicative of this very partisan, hyper-partisan situation that we're in our country that we see?
I don't think it comes down to that. I think it comes down to the traditional conservative values that we've been instilled with from a very young age in our households. And this wasn't a conversation that had been being had. You know, this is something that's fairly new to, I think, a lot of very traditional conservative Republicans. And, our party's going to have to shift. I mean, it's inevitable. I mean, as we look forward into the future, I think that there are single-issue voters, and I think that this might be one of those issues. And if the Republican Party doesn't come up with a solution to this or start talking about this issue, I think we're at risk of losing a lot of people. So it's getting over the initial hurdle of having the conversation. I think climate change is a trigger word for a lot of Republicans right now. They think that it's opening the door to something like a Green New Deal, but we can come up with conservative solutions, and I think we've done just that.
Now, what is going to be the next step in this whole process now that you've got the campaign started? It, of course, it was started earlier by the other groups, but in turn, how Indiana's going to get involved?
Obviously, taking our message directly to Republican leaders, whether that be Senator Braun, definitely wanting to start the conversation with Senator Young as well. We have been reaching out to our congressional offices and just starting the conversation, presenting this idea to them, getting their feedback, their thoughts on it. I mean, we're tweaking and things like that at the same time, too. And then I think it's going to take more of a grassroots approach. I think this isn't something that's going to be top-down. This is something that we're going to have to start from the bottom up and to be able to start within our very own College Republican chapters. You know, just introducing this, having healthy discussions, and then taking the results of these discussions back to our groups and keep pushing out our message that way.
Well, Isaiah, thank you very much for spending time to talk about this concept of how the Indiana Federation of College Republicans is joining in with this national organization to in turn persuade Hoosiers as well as national Republicans to join in on this campaign for climate change. And we hope to hear back from you with more soon.
No worries. Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome. Isaiah Mears is the state chairman of the Indiana Federation of College Republicans, and he is also the chairman of the Wabash College Republicans at Wabash College in Crawfordsville. It doesn't matter whether it happened to have been seen from the foxhole or from a cockpit of an aircraft, maybe seen from a ship deck or maybe even from a mess deck or even still from a behind-the-scenes office desk. They're all stories that deserve to be told and to be chronicled. And that's what the Veterans History Project is all about. And we have with us the director of the Library of Congress's Veterans History Project, now retired, Colonel Karen Lloyd. And Colonel Lloyd, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Oh, Chris, thanks for having me. Very much appreciated.
If you will, please take a moment and talk a little bit about the Veterans History Project. How did it get started, and what are some of the general goals that you have?
Well, the Veterans History Project was started in October 2020. It was led by Representative Ron Kine, who had the idea based on a picnic he had the previous summer with his family when his dad and uncle got together and started talking about their story. And he said, you know, who else out there needs to know these stories? Mm-hmm. And the Veterans History Project really relies on volunteers like your listeners to reach out to the veterans in their lives and their communities to find out what they did, whether it was humorous, whether it was harrowing. It's these stories that are lost to history unless we find out what they are and get them somehow jotted down or listened to and recorded. And that's what we're all about, helping your listeners, volunteers, reach out to those veterans who would otherwise be lost in plain sight.
What do you see as the reason why veteran stories seem to be our stories in general?
I think veteran stories are our stories because they help us understand that these are folks from across all backgrounds, experiences, walks of life, and they have served our country, and they really prove why freedom's not free.
Now, we know that many times this is an opportunity for folks to do a little research, not only about individual research into a family member or maybe somebody from the community that they live in, but just in general, researchers taking advantage of this. How does the collection is able to be used as a research tool?
Well, the collection is used by a variety of different folks. I mean, two that really come to my mind, one is Ken Burns when he did his World War II documentary back in 2008, mm-hmm. and then again when he did his Vietnam documentary in 2017. Both times he used over 200 of our collections to look at stories and listen to stories to see which stories he wanted to use. But what I like best about it is that the veterans keep their copyright with our programs so that Ken Burns had to reach out to these veterans or their heirs and say, I'd like to use your story. Here's how I'd like to use your story. Are you up for it? Another really good example would be Liza Mundy and the book that she wrote, Code Girls, the World War II women who were told, oh, well, just tell them you're a government secretary, and they were the ones that were breaking the codes. And what I'm most pleased about is Liza said, if not for your research librarian and for the materials you had here at the library, I would not have done this book because I wouldn't have thought I had enough materials. And what I'm most pleased about is that last March, we actually had the first national Code Girl reunion here at the library, and we had six Code Girls in their mid-90s come, along with over 40 family members.
Wow.
To talk about what their loved ones did during the war.
Take a second and explain to our listeners, if they're not familiar with the term Code Girl, what does that mean?
Code Girls were the women that were asked, are you going to be engaged, and are you good at crossword puzzles? And if they weren't going to be engaged and they were good at crossword puzzles, they were breaking the codes. One of the codes that they broke was the Japanese purple box, which allowed us to be successful at Midway. And these women didn't talk to each other. Some of the stories that Liza shared with us that I absolutely adore was she said her husband and her children and her went into an intelligence museum, a spy museum, if you will, mm-hmm. and they saw a purple, this coding machine. It was the Japanese equivalent of the Enigma. And she said, oh, well, I guess I can tell you what I did during the war. And his husband says, well, dear, you were a government secretary. And she said, no, Harold, here's what I really did. So she explained to Harold and their grown children what she had done during the war breaking codes, and she had never shared that before because she felt like if she did, that she would go to jail.
Wow.
And there's a whole group of women whose stories went with them to the grave because they didn't believe they could tell their stories. And we're so grateful for the few that chose to do that. We have over 20, and Liza found even more. But what they did was absolutely amazing, and they got absolutely no recognition for it. They're starting to get recognition now, which is so rewarding to me.
Now, we talked a little bit about the collections that are there available in the Veterans History Project and people that can take advantage of it. First, let's talk first about how veterans and Gold Star families can kind of add to their stories from the collections.
Oh, I'm so glad that you mentioned Gold Star Families. 2 years ago, well, and actually 3 years ago in 2016, the end of 2016, Congress passed a law that allowed us to increase our mission to include Gold Star Families so that we can now hear from the loved ones of those that pay the ultimate sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
We have 79 collections now, and it's growing daily. What I'm most pleased about is on Friday we had Navy Senior Petty Officer Keith Sherman, who has been going around the country, and he's collected a Gold Star family story from every state, and he chose to donate them to us here at the Library of Congress and the Veterans History Project, and we couldn't be more pleased about that. And your viewers can go up loc.gov/vets or our email site, vohp@loc.gov, to learn more about what we're doing, and email us if what they see there isn't what they want. we will reach out to folks across the nation and provide, at no cost to them, a trained oral historian to help them gain a new skill set. We also have field kits that say how to do it. And if you have a tablet or a smartphone, you're halfway there. And we also have sample questions so that people will have a sense of, you know, how do you do an interview? What are the questions you should be asking? Some of my favorite questions, quite frankly, as a part of that arc of the story, is when you ask the veteran, so how did, what, one, why the heck did you sign up? And then followed by, so how did you get from home to that first duty station? And for some vets, it's the first plane ride, train ride, or bus they ever took. And then the most fun, quite frankly, is when you say, and who at that first duty station made the biggest impression on you, made a difference in your life? And they all remember the name. They all say, oh, my God, Sergeant Brown. And then they'll go and talk about it. And their eyes light up because it's something that they probably haven't talked about in an awfully long time.
Colonel Lloyd, thank you for the information. Once again, give us the web address so if anybody wants to find out more about not only what's out there, but also to be able to get the information and contribute to it. What's the address for the Veterans History Project?
Yes, our website is loc.gov/vets. With an S.
And we've been talking with retired Army Colonel Karen Lloyd. She is the director of the Library of Congress's Veterans History Project, which tells stories because veteran stories are our stories, too. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Time once again for Building Northwest Indiana, and here's your host, Kevin Comerford.
Welcome to another edition of Building Northwest Indiana Radio. My name is Kevin Comerford, and I'm the Director of Professional Development at the Construction Advancement Foundation, and I will be your host today. Today's guest is Dr. James Arendis of the Construction Advancement Foundation. Dr. James Arendis is Director of the Construction Safety Institute. Dr. Arendis, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
So with your role in the Construction Safety Institute at the Construction Advancement Foundation, you deal a lot with contractors and union construction workers and safety. Can you talk a little bit about why safety is so important in the construction industry?
Yes. The construction industry has changed over time. And if you go back in history, safety was not a real important factor in the industry because everyone paid the maximum amount of insurance to insure their people from injury. So it created this equalizing factor, and everyone just had to pay this high rate, and no one was really concerned about it. Now I'm going back 40 years ago. But today, things have changed, and have changed over the years, where the amount of insurance that a contractor pays is based on their performance now. So that's a factor that's really changed the industry. And beyond that, the customers that the contractors work for have become much more advanced in occupational safety, and they've actually set standards for the contractors in order to work in their facilities. So, you know, in Northwest Indiana, we have a pretty high profile of work that's done in manufacturing. So industrial construction, we call it. So that would include the steel mills, the refineries, power plants, you know, all the big industry in Northwest Indiana. And it's probably, to just throw out some percentages, the amount of construction work that's done in Northwest Indiana, I would say at some point it might be 60% industrial. And when big jobs occur, it could be as much as 80% industrial. So, you know, in our area, the steel mills and the refineries have all given this a lot of thought over the years. I've been with the foundation for 22 years, and I've watched this change. And as the owners become more sophisticated, they're putting a higher standard of requirements on the contractors. So we're all kind of elevating together improving workplace safety, workplace conditions. And the owners, the customers that we have done even some things where they pre-qualify contractors through third parties, where you would think that the most important part of the work is performing the work. But a lot of these large industrial facilities, have third-party organizations that they use to pre-qualify the safety of the contractors before they even can apply or to do any work, bid on any kind of work. And what it's done is really changed the focus on safety is now kind of number one.
What kind of factors go into those rates or those the system that the third-party administrators use to judge a company's safety?
There's a number of factors, and one of them, to make this kind of simple, would be to look at the contractor's injury rates. And those are rates that the contractor has to maintain because of OSHA requirements. And those are actually certified numbers. So these certified signed-off numbers go to these third-party groups, and they have a criteria for that. And each industry has a little different criteria for all these factors that I'm going to discuss. Another factor would be the experience modification rate, which is an insurance rate, and it's actually done through a government commission where this rate actually dictates how much that contractor is going to pay for insurance. So there's a number that comes out of that, and like the average contractor in the country would be a factor of one. And if they're better than that factor of one, then we get into decimals, right? If they're over, it's 1 point something else. And most facilities won't even use anyone with a factor of one or higher. Most of them are 0.9 or even lower than that.
So in other words, you got to be under the industry average.
Yes. And then on top of that, they have the contractor submit their safety manual, which in order to meet this criteria, it's probably about 4 or 5 inches thick. And the third-party assessors kind of go through it and determine if you've met all the standards that have been set by that user. So in the end, you get like a kind of a school grade rating, you know. And if your rating's not high enough, then you don't qualify. So then you're going to have to do some work on your programs. You may have to wait until your safety incident rates go down, or you can improve your insurance rates. So that's a kind of a simple – it's actually a really intense process. So when you hear some of the industry and our industry and the users talk about safety first, this is actually kind of putting your money where your mouth is. So you're not – going to be able to work in any of these facilities until you pass this safety first criteria.
Well, that was a lot of great information, Doctor. I appreciate you joining us today.
Anytime, Kevin.
That'll do it for today's edition of Building Northwest Indiana. I would like to thank our guest, Dr. James Arendis. He is the director of the Construction Safety Institute at the Construction Advancement Foundation. To find out more information about the Construction Safety Institute, you can visit CAFNWIN.org.
You can hear part two of this conversation next Tuesday. Building Northwest Indiana is supported by the Construction Advancement Foundation, and it comes every Tuesday here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts of Building Northwest Indiana can also be found at our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
The first neighborhood that I remember growing up in was on the east side of Gary on Massachusetts Street. And my parents brought me home from the hospital there. And I lived there until I was 4 and a half, just about 5 years old. And it was a very tight-knit community. I remember the families all interacted. The other thing about the neighborhood I remember, there were people from all walks of lives. My dad was a teacher. Across the street, my mother's best friend was my physician. We had other teachers on the block. We had people that worked in the steel mill. And all of us lived in one community. And that allowed, I think, growing up, people to see that all of these things were attainable. I think that's part of what doesn't happen today, because once people get to a certain financial level, they tend to move away from the original community. I've never used that term, black flight, but I think there are a lot of things involved with that. Certainly people have a tendency, if they make a certain amount of money, to want to live in a different home. In this area, there are nice, beautiful homes in different sections of Gary, in Miller, for instance. Even on the west side of Gary, there are some beautiful homes, but a lot of times people have felt like they want to live in another community. I think the media has played a big role in that, because they have demonized this community for so long that people bought into this notion that no one wants to live in Gary, and that Gary is unsafe, and this is not somewhere that you would want to live, and particularly if you've gotten to the point where you want to have put a lot of money into a home, you would not want to put that money into Gary. And then, of course, we have to discuss the crime, but the crime is associated to the jobs. And so when you take jobs out of a community and you replace those jobs with guns and money, then you have something that's volatile. And as a result, then you start to, you know, have these notions that I can't live a safe life. I think the white flight really is based on racism, purely racism. I don't care that I live in a nice home. I don't care what the community looks like, if it's predominantly black or if there's even some blacks, I would prefer not to live there or do business there. And that is what really has happened to Gary, Indiana.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. In South Lake County, residents in the Hanover Community School District are going to be asked in the May 5th primary election, a separate item on the ballot, by the way, to approve a capital referendum question. The question is very simple, and there's a lot more behind that than the simple question itself. So we've turned to the source. We're turning to the superintendent of the Hanover Community School District, Mary McCauley, to tell us more about not only the project that the school district is asking to be able to fund, with a lot of things that are on the plate on this one, but the reason that there's the reason behind why all this is needed. And Ms. McCauley, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we'll start out first here, I guess, with the usual questions here, who, what, where, when, why, and all that. First, if you will, tell us a little bit about, and we'll get into the details as to, I guess, a lot of why this is needed, because that's a big part of the question that you're asking residents in the district to help out. But tell us specifically about the capital project itself. We're talking, what, a total of $79 million. It sounds horrendously large, but there's a lot that goes in there. That, isn't it?
Yes, there is a lot that goes into it, and it includes all four of our buildings. Primarily, it addresses our issue with our increasing enrollment, because we are one of the fastest growing districts in the state, and our ADM, which is our average daily membership, has just increased each year. For example, this year we're at 2,444 students. The year before, we were at 2381. The year before that, 2293. So each year, we have seen our enrollment go up, and there is so much building around the area. So we have run out of space. Part of the building project includes building a new upper elementary building so that we can move some of the children out of our existing elementary buildings and move the fifth grade out of the middle school. We moved the fifth grade to the middle school a couple of years ago with the hopes of freeing up some space at the elementaries. The only thing that did was they filled in that space almost immediately. So we are just jam-packed, and we now have two mobile classrooms in our district.
I understand that in the, we'll say, the last 4 years, you've added 500 students to the enrollment there in the school district, and like added even 33 just coming out of the holiday break. Is it amazing that you would pick up so many extra students in just a short period of time?
No, the houses are going up quicker than we can keep on top of them.
Mm-hmm.
To get an idea of just all of the planned and platted neighborhoods, approximately 27 more homes are planned out here. So we didn't anticipate quite the growth that we're seeing. We had a demographer out several years ago, but this has far surpassed what we had anticipated. So we have to, last year the referendum failed, so we did some things differently as far as going out to the community, being more proactive. We've done a couple of surveys. We've done something called Thought Exchange, where we've asked the community to weigh in on what they think we need to be attentive to as far as our facilities. And that is how this whole $79 million project came into being.
Now, for folks that are not all that familiar with the Hanover Community School District, most of the school district really encompasses around Cedar Lake, but there's some areas on all sides, I guess, that's part of the district, right?
Correct. We have people that live in Dyer. We have people that live in St. John, Crown Point address. So we service a large range.
When you take a look at such a large, physically large school district, and the schools that are spread out, of course, to be able to serve all these residents, you have to try to plan for the future, I suppose. And you've had to be able to make up, of course, with all this added enrollment. I understand you've even had to add some portable classrooms at some of the schools as well.
That's absolutely correct. We have a portable classroom at Lincoln Elementary because there are no classrooms left. We have a portable classroom at Hanover Central Middle School. Over at the middle school, we have more kids now than we do at the high school. So the mobile classroom is necessary because we have teachers on carts going room to room. We have teacher lounges that are being utilized, plan rooms. There is just absolutely no available space.
When it was time to be able to, and we had a lot of consultation, I know, with the financial experts as well as with your principals and the teachers and everybody on the staff of the school district, when it was time to put all this information together, what kind of material did you have to present, certainly to the school board, because they have to buy into it as well. They're just as much a part of it as well as everybody who works for the school district officially. What kind of effort did you have to make with the school board to let them know, if they haven't already known, obviously, how important this is, and also, too, to talk about the cost to the taxpayers, because they're going to have to, I'm sure, do a lot of this selling, so to speak, by themselves.
Correct. Well, we had to share the information as far as our enrollment, how much it has grown since 2012. In addition to that, we shared plans about where the new building would be located, what would be included in that, how we can address the needs of the high school because these kids are all going to matriculate to the high school, how we can do some renovations there to address technology, trades classes, et cetera. Had to share that. We had to talk about how our AV continues to go up. Last year it increased by 10%. This has become a destination district. People truly want to be here and raise their families here. We have an exceptional school system. In addition to that, we had to share with, and bond council was very helpful, and the board has been so supportive. We had architects come in and look at our facilities. We've also talked about how the debt can be structured so it has minimal impact to the taxpayer until that debt falls off. And the board has been integral to this every step of the way.
Now, I understand that I'm not sure if it is out there on the website as we speak, but I'm sure that if it isn't, it will be soon, that you're going to have a referendum tax calculator put onto the Hanover Community School Corporation website so that people who go onto the website, which by the way is hanover.k12.in.us, will be able to put in their own figures as to how much the property value happens to be for their house or commercial or business property or whatever it may be, and see what kind of impact the referendum would have, the project in general actually would have based on the referendum.
Correct. And we anticipate that'll be up next week.
Wow. So, I guess you can't start too soon, to be sure. And certainly because you have only till May and have everybody to be aware of this, it's really, really quite a kind of a harried situation you folks are in right now, right?
It absolutely is. And that tax calculator, what's nice about that is the average taxpayer can enter in their information and it'll tell them exactly to the penny what they'll be paying. We also have a finance director who has met with taxpayers who've brought in their tax statements. We will meet with anyone who asks to meet with us. We're being very forthright and open. We don't want any surprises.
I know you've gone through this procedure before. The school district has gone through this procedure before and unfortunately did not get the support from the voters that time around. What is different this time around with the project? Is it the scale of the project itself? Is it the tax rate, or is there some other factors that come into it? Or is it really just the realization that we're such a growing school district, we need to have the help right now?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. I think it is the realization that we are a growing district, and all you have to do is drive around the area and you can see homes going up everywhere. The other thing that I think we did, it was such a harried procedure last year, but what we did, we took a step back after it failed. It failed by 68 votes. So we took a long, hard look at, okay, what did we do? What can we do differently? And we were upfront as far as getting as much community input as we could. We wanted to know their thoughts. In addition to that, we've done community forums. We have more community forums scheduled. We surveyed surveyed the community. So I think there was a lot more ownership in this.
Well, Superintendent McCauley, thank you very much for being with us to talk about this. We hope to have you on again as we get closer to the day that the referendum question will be out there for voters in the Hanover Community School Corporation for them to see. And we hope that if people have questions, they can go on the website, get the information, the answers to their questions, and hopefully they will be able to go into the polling place there in the Cedar Lake area a bit more informed than they might have been the last time around. And we wish you all the best of luck on this.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
Well, you're very welcome. Mary McCauley is the superintendent of the Hanover Community School Corporation, and voters are being asked in the Hanover Community School Corporation to approve a question that will be on the May 5th ballot that in turn would approve a $79 million capital project. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, we're on the subject of public schools. A Chicago area nonprofit fund is going to take a big project in hand, a first for Northwest Indiana. The Big Shoulders Fund CEO Josh Hale was with us to talk about a multi-year project with the Catholic Diocese of Gary School District. And it's being supported by a generous gift from the Bruce and Beth White Family Foundation. Hale talks first about the Big Shoulders organization, and then he talks in particular about the White's involvement in the project.
Big Shoulders Fund is a nonprofit, independent charitable organization that was founded back in 1986 at the inspiration of Cardinal Bernardine, but by a group of business and civic leaders who were working really overall to strengthen the city of Chicago by really ensuring that all children have access to a quality education. And the second largest system of schools then and now is the Catholic schools. Mm-hmm. And so they came together and formed this this foundation really to raise funds to provide access. How to assure that every child found the right school, their parents knew that they were in the right place and a safe and structured environment. And over time, you know, at the onset, we were primarily focused on scholarships, but over time, we have really broadened our investments to focus certainly on the child, ensuring that he or she has the resources to attend the school of their choice, but also that they have the supports. And that's, you know, whether it's after school or before school, it's tutoring, it's coach, whatever it is, mentorship, and really kind of surrounding the child with all the tools they need to succeed. from elementary school to high school and really then into college. But we also started to invest in ensuring that these schools we support remain open and viable. You know, first and foremost, these schools represent a community-based organization in the neighborhoods they serve, a beacon of hope, a open and operating institution, and we want to make sure that they were not only open, but that they provided the very best product. So we've increasingly invested in teachers and classrooms, and that's everything from recruiting teachers into a pipeline from right out of college into our classrooms, supporting them, coaching them, helping them to understand the data associated with each of their students, finding great curriculum, and then training them and supporting them, and helping really students to succeed at a higher level. And so academics in the classroom are a big part of it, and creating a pipeline of teachers and principals over time. Mm-hmm. And then the third area is really the business side of the school, because at the end of the day, these inner-city Catholic schools are about a $1 to $1.5 million business. And so we really work with a principal who's primarily an academic leader, but has been asked to really run the quote-unquote business. So helping them with operational support, whether that's cash flow management or it's budgeting or developing a long-term plan or marketing, all those things that come into running a small business successfully. And the third area really is leadership. How do we help overall not only attract and develop the best principals, but retain them over time? We work with 75 schools here in Chicago. It's about 20,000 children, 80% minority, about 70% poverty. And I would say their success rate is what we really hang our hat on, is that it's great that we have these schools open as community-based organizations. It's great to provide access and we invest. But we also want to know that these students really go on to succeed in life and to become great citizens. We graduate, our high schools see about a 94% graduation rate. Our scholars go on to college at very high rates. We see them not only graduating high school, but actually enrolling in high school at about 86%. And then we see about 92% of them persist. And of those going on to college, 80-plus percent are going to four-year universities. And then the long-term, you know, as they matriculate through college, we see that our students are graduating college at two times the national rate. And for African-American and Hispanic students, that's three times and four times, respectively. They're employed at a higher rate than their peers. They're volunteering at a higher rate than their peers. They're earning at a higher rate than their peers. But they're also donating to charities. They're active in the community and really becoming the citizens that we all dream they could become. And I think that's ultimately our long-term goal, is really to make sure these students from under-resourced communities become the citizens and contribute to society that we all know they can become.
Mm-hmm. How did Big Shoulders... I'm sorry.
That's a kind of a nutshell of how we work mm-hmm. at Big Shoulders Fund. Right. And we're very excited about this opportunity.
Yeah.
To be invited into and starting our work in Northwest Indiana. And, you know, we really, given our mission is to serve in under-resourced communities, the invitation of Beth and Bruce White to develop a program, the openness, the enthusiasm of all the folks we've met in Northwest Indiana, from community leaders to families to principals in the diocese, has been overwhelming. And we share a lot of the same values and desires, and we're very hopeful.
How did the Big Shoulders Fund get together with the White Family Foundation to take up this topic, and certainly to take up this long range, since we're talking about $16 million over a decade, $16 million that's going to be eventually being invested into the Catholic schools?
Yeah, we got to know Beth and Bruce, who's both their roots are in Indiana. Bruce, obviously, from Northwest Indiana, and Beth from Southwest Indiana. And they were living in Chicago, had moved here about a decade ago, and some friends on our board introduced them to Big Shoals Fund. And they were enthusiastic about the mission right from the get-go, and they got involved with one of our schools in the far southeast side of Chicago, which is just about on the border of Indiana. And a school that was really struggling, and but provided a great outcome. With Beth and Bruce, what I've learned is when they get involved, they get involved. And they got not only themselves involved as mentors, but they invited their children. They invited their friends. And they have many mentors of these students now. And I love, you know, Beth and Bruce come back and talk to us about the students they've been out visiting, the students' performances they've gone to see. They invite their scholars down for shows. So hands-on involved in the mission, really active. And, you know, I think the mission fell in love with Beth and Bruce as much as they had fell in love with the mission.
It's Josh Hale with the Big Shoulders Fund of Chicago, which is working with the Diocese of Gary Schools. Some key retirement planning changes coming up in 2020 to talk about, and that's why we turn to Greg Hammer, who is our Northwest Indiana financial advisor. Greg, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, tell us a little bit about the retirement provisions that contribute to an IRA that the SECURE Act is all about.
Yeah, there's a lot of changes with the SECURE Act. Chris, you may have noticed it's about 900 pages long, so we're still digesting it, but there are some major changes with it. The one you mentioned in specific with contributions to the IRA. In the past, once you reached the minimum retirement distribution age of 70 and a half, you were no longer allowed to make contributions to a traditional IRA, even if you were working. Well, that law has been revised, and if you are working, even if it's beyond the 70 and a half age, you can still make contributions based on the same guidelines before in terms of dollar limits.
There are some interesting points here with these new benefits for a spousal IRAs. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, and it's really an extension of some of the, you know, the rules that apply to the traditional IRAs for contributions. The same thing is also allowed now for spousal IRAs. And those IRAs, whether a spouse had earned income or not, they could make contributions into a spousal IRA based on earnings of the other spouse. Well, now those rules were restricted, just like previously with the traditional IRAs, to the 70 and a half age. The spousal IRA contributions have also been expanded as well to go beyond the 70 and a half, so long as the working spouse does earn money. And as long as they earn the dollar amount to make up those contributions, which, you know, currently is about $7,000 each respectively, they can make contributions up to $14,000 as long as a spouse has $14,000 of earnings.
One of the things we should note as well, too, that there's a different starting age for required minimum distribution. What's the status that the SECURE Act covers in that?
Yeah, and I think it's actually going to create a lot more clarity. The 70 and a half required minimum distribution age was always confusing for a lot of folks. Now the new starting age is going to be 72. So that's when you will be required to take distributions from your qualified plans. It will still allow exclusions if you're working in at 401k to go beyond the 72. So the tables haven't changed in terms of the dollar amount that's going to be required to take out. But because you'll be starting at age 72 instead of 70 and a half, they will be higher.
There's a new retirement issue out there called a stretch IRA. Is that a new one or just a different way to put it?
Well, the stretch IRA, this is probably one of the most impactful things, I think, from the change standpoints with the SECURE Act, at least for, you know, the individual and families. The stretch IRAs was a provision that existed in the laws. If you inherited an IRA, as a non-spouse, you could go into what they called a stretch IRA. Now, there's really not a stretch IRA. It was more the terminology. What an individual would do is take a distribution over several generations. Now, they have eliminated that opportunity for most individuals. There are exceptions. There's always exceptions to the specific rules with disability, young children. But essentially, for most individuals that are going to inherit those IRAs as a non-spouse, if there's more than a 10-year difference, they will be required to take those distributions at the longest time frame of 10 years. So they're going to force those individuals to exhaust those accounts on a timely manner as opposed to being able to stretch it out over several generations. So it will create more of a tax impact for them.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer about some of the changes coming up with the stretch IRAs and other things in the new accounts that are coming forth in 2020. One of these, I note, is there's a special immunity for employers that are sponsoring a 401k plan. Tell us about these changes that the employers will have.
Well, yeah, and this is very unique because in the past, most 401ks were limited into the types of programs or offerings, I should say, that they could have inside the 401k. One in specific was, being able to offer an annuity within the 401k. And in the past, a lot of employers or sponsored people who sponsored these 401ks just simply didn't do it because they would expose themselves to particular liabilities or lawsuits from any disgruntled employees who did not like the annuity that they obtained through their plan. So now they have structured it where if those programs are offered by the employer, then mm-hmm. the liability would fall to the insurance company, which is really where it should fall anyways. So the existing change should allow for plans to open the gamut of investment vehicles into the annuity world.
Now, finally, the SECURE Act is going to make some changes, and if that can make it easier, I guess, even for small businesses to be able to offer some help to their employees for retirement. Tell us where the small businesses fit into all of this.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing is a lot of small organizations, small groups, it often became very cost ineffective or expensive to offer group plans if there was not a lot of employees. Now they're allowing the individuals to go into what they call multi-employer 401ks, where they can group plans from two or more separate businesses to make it more cost-effective and essentially provide value where they couldn't before. They're typically smaller businesses that can't afford to run their own plan, and prior to the SECURE Act, the separate employees had to do something, common, like be part of a trade association. Now it allows them to be unrelated businesses to form that group, which should open the opportunity for a lot of small businesses to offer programs like the 401k to employees that they just simply could not before.
That's Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for listening. We hope you'll join us tomorrow.